This is Hugh Simpson, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 14th of April, 2011. Hugh Simpson, Part 1.
My name is Hugh Walter Simpson, and I was born in the manse of Ceres, Cooper Fife, on 4/4/1931.
So you're just 80 years old?
Just 80 last week. But my birthday's been postponed because my wife was having her second knee in hospital, and we decided that, like Easter, it's a feast that can be changed slightly. So actually, all my presents are still under the bed, and we've got family coming home from various places like Barcelona on Sunday, and we're going to have the birthday then.
What sort of education did you have, Hugh?
What sort of?
Education.
Well, being born in a fife manse with my father on the minimum stipend of the Church of Scotland, you'd have thought I would have gone to the local school and so on. But the fact is that my parents were unusual. My mother was a doctor and she was interested in research. And my father was not your normal pastoral minister in a way. He had a degree from Edinburgh. And they had a lot of friends who were very interested in education. And my elder sister went to the local school, and this was full of what in Scotland we call Keelys. And it was a disaster. I don't want to make too much of a social thing about it, but the reality was my parents realised that was wrong. She finished up at the Quaker School in York, which that choice makes... tells you a little bit about my parents. How did they get there? How did she get there? And when my turn came, I was just sent to a local prep school in St Andrews. And then they took a lot of soundings about from people all over the country because their contacts were much wider than normal people. And they sent me to a school called Branston in Dorset. Now, Branston was a bit like... It was a bit like the Kurt Hahn schools, that it wasn't all games, there was an unusual system of education, and so a lot of music and art and things like that. And so at the age of 14, I was put on a train to London and then to get the express out to Blandford, and I spent three years there. And then... my parents wanted me to do medicine because that was the family tradition. There are a lot of family connections with medicine, such as my granduncle, who was the pioneer of anaesthesia, of chloroform. So what my parents wanted was that I would do medicine. Now, Scottish education is different from English because you start earlier. You start at the age of 17. And that meant that when I got to Edinburgh, most of the other pupils there, and this was the post-war era when nearly all the people going to university were ex-service, but I just was short of that. So I had a hell of a struggle to start with, doing physics and chemistry and things like that, the basic subjects before starting medicine. But after I'd recovered from that difficult first year, I then passed all the exams and became a doctor in 1954. And it was during this time, while working as a house physician in a fever hospital in Edinburgh, I saw the advertisement for the Antarctic. And that was how it started, and an interview in Millwall in London. And the next thing, I had a telegram, "You'll report to Berth 37, Southampton, to be the medical officer on the Royal Research Ship John Biscoe." That's the old John Biscoe, the wooden-built John Biscoe. And I went down there, and that was... I met John Heap, who had done geography at the university at the same time, and he was into a study of the distribution of ice in the Southern Ocean, and he came down on the Biscoe to see for himself what that distribution was. And Drummond Matthews, who was another rather exceptional Fitz, who was very concerned with the paleomagnetism of rocks. So these were two sort of academic friends. But when I got onto the John Biscoe, I found that I was in a cabin which said certified for one seaman. And there was hardly, you could just stand on the floor. and everything creaked because it was wood. And in the cabinet was instruments for opening the cranium and things like that, which, of course, I had no idea what to do. And so then I discovered I was in a very privileged position in the Royal Research Ship because I was the medical officer for the ship, whereas the other people in the survey were put down below. I messed with the officers, and so had it much easier than they had it on the trip. First of all, to the Canary Islands, and then to Montevideo. At Montevideo, I was asked for my medical report of the ship, and of course, I didn't realize I even had to make one, so I had to go and write it quickly. The ship had broken down, and so we had a whole month in Monte while the ship diesel electric engines got rewired. And during this time, we went inland with Drummond Matthews and John Hay to explore the interior of Uruguay and succeeded in getting ourselves arrested by the local police. Didn't know what we were and that sort of thing. So that was really the start of it.
Can I ask you why it is you wanted to go to the Antarctic? What attracted you to it?
Why did I want to go? I think that basically I'm very immature, and immature people, children, want to explore. They don't want to get married and have insurance policies, life insurance policies, and a mortgage and things like that. They really want to, they're interested in what's on the other side. And my mother had once been to a lecture by Shackleton, and I think she wanted me to. She didn't say as much, but I think she wanted that. So this was all part of that. Now, I was actually called up for the Navy at the time as National Service, but the reality is I was given a choice of deferment in the Antarctic, and I thought that sounded much more exciting. But the other thing was I was very interested in mountaineering, and I set myself a whole lot of targets. For example, shortly before graduation, with two others, we climbed all the 4,000-foot mountains in Scotland without support in one go, which is sort of 90-something miles and so on and so forth, which was the first time it had ever been done in 2 days, under 2 days. And so that was the sort of person I was. And then there was the Cairngorms, where I was mainly interested in the ascent of all the 9 highest Cairngorms in a day, for example. I thought that was worth doing at the time. I'm not sure now. I've got too mature. I've matured slightly out of these sort of childhood things of sort of point scoring or something like that. And now what's actually happened is that my medical training and this exploration thing has gone into medical research, and I'm looking for a test to find out who's got breast cancer, who is going to die and who is not. Now, the Ministry of Health asked me to look into this because that's a major problem in medicine at this time. With 1 in 8 women getting breast cancer, roughly half are going to die from the disease and half are going to be okay. So that half can really go home and don't need to have radiotherapy, chemotherapy, very expensive things. But apart from that, their whole life is destroyed by the attendance of the clinics and that sort of thing. So what's really happened is that my exploration has matured into a study of breast cancer. And after I came back from the Antarctic, I went up the ladder in medicine so that I became a consultant pathologist that's interested in the science of disease, how diseases are caused, what the complications are, that sort of thing. I practiced that, then I became a professor in Glasgow University as well as a consultant. And that gave me the chance to get cases of breast cancer, and then find out 20 years later who had died and who hadn't. But before that, I developed an idea as to how I could tell the difference. Now, the way this actually happened was that in the Antarctic, I became very interested in the effect of stress hormones on the people in the base and in the field. And this led to an interest in the fact that the stress hormones have a 24-hour rhythm. They're much higher at breakfast time. Cortisol is much higher at breakfast time than other times of the day. And I thought it would be rather interesting to study the rhythm of the stress hormones on a day that didn't last 24 hours to find out what happened to the rhythm. So after the Antarctic, with the experience of the Antarctic, I went to took an expedition to Spitsbergen, where it's light all the time in the summer. And we had what happened was that I'd got married in the meantime. My wife was expecting a baby. We decided, because of all the Antarctic experience I had, we could take the baby to age 4 months. And we lived for 6 months in Spitsbergen in a hut that had belonged to the Scottish explorer Bruce in the 1920s. So we had a secure hut, but we could make night if we wanted by putting blacks over the windows. And in the base, which was completely isolated, about 70 miles from Longyearbyen, we were all governed by clocks which had the hairspring shortened, so they ran they ran 3 hours fast a day, but we pretended they were right. So meals were always on the clock time. And every 2 hours we collected urine samples to study the hormones in it to find out what happened to this 24-hour rhythm on what was in fact a day lasting only 21 hours. And because the day lasted in 21 hours, after 7 days, we had seven lots of 3 hours saved up, 21 hours, so we had extra days. So we had an 8-day week instead of a 7-day week. The question was, what did the hormones do? Well, we brought back 2,000 samples of urine, and I got a chance to work in Glasgow to analyse the hormones in the urine. And what we found was that most rhythms in man stick to 24 hours or slightly more than 24 hours. But other rhythms like sodium excretion go on to 21 hours, which is what we had. And this had relevance obviously to space, where you're free of all terrestrial influences. That was a PhD. And as a result of that, I got an invitation to go to the University of Minnesota, the main centre in the world for the study of biological rhythms, where they have the software to analyse rhythms in data. And so I'm a visiting professor at the University of Minnesota. And at this time, I was interviewed by a CNN reporter. And I was telling her about this 21-hour day study and so on. And she said, "Doctor," she said, "are you just accumulating the sum total of human knowledge? Are you doing something interesting?" And I took this rather to heart. And I realized that one of the most interesting things that I was involved with as a consultant pathologist was the diagnosis of breast cancer. And the big problem with breast cancer is, who is going to die from it? That's about half the patients. And who is not? And that would be a tremendous thing if I could really do that.
How far away are you now from coming to a conclusion about that?
Well, I did an email this morning about taking out patents for a test. And this is what all this is.
Papers on your desk.
And that's the signal there. That's the survivors versus the non-survivors. But it's extremely difficult. And intellectually, I'm getting old. And for example, I got unexpected results today, and it upsets things slightly. But I think I can pass it on.
So your ambition is to be able to decide which breast cancer sufferers require treatment and which ones don't.
Exactly. That is the big problem with the Ministry of Health.
And somewhere there will be an indicator. If you can put your finger on it.
Well, the indicator is that I developed a bra, an electronic bra. And this measures the menstrual cycle of the breast. It measures the rate at which the blood's going through the breast during the menstrual cycle.
This is a bra with electrodes?
Electronic. So it can hold That little box can hold 4,000 temperatures.
So these are thermometers in the
cuffs? Yes. It's accurate to a 20th of a degree.
It
has a clock, and the clock can move at different speeds. So all my patients wear this, and then you get this rhythm. And the question is the rhythm different in those who are going to die versus those who are not going to die? And that's the crux. So we're in a slightly sensitive ground now because there's a question of patents. And the reason I want to patent it, and I've got plenty of money, that's not the issue. The issue is a commercial company going to be interested in taking up the thing and getting it into practice? And I want them to give up, you see.
This has nothing to do with the Antarctic, except that this work has grown out of your Antarctic experiences. So let me ask you a couple of questions, and we'll go back to the Antarctic afterwards. How would you persuade a woman that she did not need treatment? Because in some respects, she's taking a risk in saying, I don't need treatment for this disease. I'm going to get better of my own accord.
Well, what happens is you have to have the lump removed.
Right.
She comes back to the follow-up clinic. And the surgeon is looking at all her data. For example, does she have glands involved in the axilla? Glands are a bad thing. That's the one thing I agree on.
This is under the arm.
Yes, that's where, because that's the vascular drainage from the breast. All body tissues have got blood going in and blood going out. Mm. And the vascular drainage is partly lymphatic, where the large molecules go, and partly venous, where everything else goes, including the red cells. And so I was able to collect patients in this post-operative phase. And the question is, each menstrual cycle is a rehearsal of pregnancy. You're getting ready to become pregnant. You lay an egg in the middle of the cycle. Is it going to be fertilized? And if it's not, then the breast then goes back to where it was and it starts another cycle. Is it analogous to the electrocardiogram of the heart that from the parameters of the changes in the electrocardiogram, you can see whether somebody's had a heart attack? Does that tell you the pathology? Mm. So that's what I've been doing the last 30 years.
I'm fascinated by this, but my job is to talk to you about the Antarctic, which is a great shame. Can you relate what you're doing now to some of that early work?
It's all really the same thing, you see. It's because that I think explorers are immature. They don't want the security of marriage and the things I talked about, insurance policies, mortgages, and all these sort of things. They're constantly looking. And research is the mature version of that.
Right. But in medical medical context, this research you're doing now into breast cancer, does that have any relationship at all to the blood sampling tests you were doing on your FID colleagues back in the 50s?
Yes, you see, the connection was that the eosinophils that I studied in the Antarctic, which get less in people who have got lots of stress hormones circulating in them because their interpretation of their environment is stressful, like they might be leaving on a journey the next day or they might have just heard the ship with our parcels on is sinking, things like that. And we have all that documented. These hormones are cyclical. And the cyclicity is now part of a new science called chronobiology, the biology of time, that all living things have a structure in time as well as a structure in space. They're like we live for 70 years in term, whereas mayflies live for one day. The tortoise, the sole, Napoleon. It's all a structure in time. And the application of the stress hormones, which are rhythmic, is that that's part of chronobiology, and I'm now applying chronobiology to the science of disease.
So let's go back then to the work you were doing in the Antarctic. You went south as a medical officer on the ship.
Yes.
But I guess you'd already created your own research program.
The Antarctic authorities wanted me to study sleep rhythms in the Antarctic, and the unusual daylight conditions of the Antarctic, which had been done by a chap called Masterton. And I just couldn't get set alight by that research. I found I could feel motivated enough to go through very arduous work in collecting the data. And the other thing is, like that CNN reporter who asked me, are you just accumulating the sum total of human knowledge? Are you doing something important? Because the currency, of course, is your life. A lot of people don't quite understand the currency of life. They would look at the Saturday versions of the paper and think what holidays they might do in the Seychelles. Other people think, oh, I'm going to spend some of my life there. I'm going to lose some of my life. Perhaps I should spend it on something more important. And a lot depends, I think, on your origins, what your parents might have interpreted, because you often think back in decisions what your parents might want you to do or wish you to do or whether you thought they were right or not. But it's all part of the same story.
So tell me about the research programme you set out for yourself then as you headed south. What was your ambition?
Well, when I set off on the John Biscoe, I was so soon after being a house officer in a fever hospital where our main cases were poliomyelitis. The epidemic of poliomyelitis in the early in the 1950s was very, very serious. Suddenly I came to grips with life and death. You'd get a young man coming in unable to move a limb. Mm-hmm. And so that was the importance. But then getting onto the John Biscoe was a full-time involvement of your mind as to becoming, going south, the experience of the Canary Islands, Montevideo, Port Stanley, playing billiards with the governor, and so on. So to some extent, you started with a blank sheet. You had all this education behind you. The question was, but what were you going to do after the ship had left and you'd been in the base for a week? What were you going to do next? And that was when I got interested in studying what is called a limnological survey of Lake Bokella, the Lake Bokella, a small lake near Hope Bay base, which was thawed for about a month a year. Did anything actually live in that water? I had a microscope in the base. I could look at the water, look at the weeds in the water, see what was on the weeds, photograph them with my Leica camera, and provide a documentation. And I found that Shackleton similar documentation in his book. That was the start of it. And then I just sortly thought, well, perhaps eastern fields would be interesting to study, to monitor, get a profile of people living in the Antarctic, living in the security of the base hut, and the very stressful environment of sledging in the Antarctic Peninsula, where it's very common to get winds of 100 knots or something like that, thin sea ice, the uncertainties of that. Some people who love doing that, other people who weren't really suitable for that sort of thing. And I thought, well, a profile of these things could be a worthwhile time in the Antarctic, could make a worthwhile time in the Antarctic just to see what was what. And that's what I did. And I'd found, in fact, that when there was major excitements on the base, like hearing that the relief ship was sinking or, for example, in a small boat rescue I got involved with, that the people were highly stressed the next day when they could have been blown out to sea. And so suddenly I had an objective measure of what was going on inside their mind. And that fascinated me as a doctor. And the fact that one person in particular, who was in a profound state of stress according to his eosinophil cells virtually throughout the year, had to be sent home because he was unable to cope. And so that was, when I came back, that was then written up as a thesis. And so that changed that chapter, but it gave an interest in these cells and the rhythm in these cells, and that led to my later research.
So the blood samples, how are you establishing what the cells are doing? You're taking blood samples and urine samples?
In the Antarctic, it was mainly blood samples.
Right.
And all you needed to do was to have a syringe and one needle. I used to sharpen the needles up in a carborundum and look at them with the microscope to make sure they were sharp. The trouble was that the bevel end of the needle tended to bend away from the carborundum. And I used to bore the needles up on a billy can with the primers. And nobody thought twice about that. And of course, explorers have big veins. It's easy to get blood out of them. And then you get just a few drops of blood. And then you add various things to it, which makes the red cells and the other things you don't want to see invisible. Whereas these curious cells called eosinophils, that's the eosin is like the red stuff in red ink. These cells particularly picked up this red dye. And then you put the drop onto a special slide which had an etched draft board on it. And then you look down the microscope at these etched squares and you'd see how many cells had picked up the red stain. And I made hundreds and hundreds of counts, people in the base, people in the field, and then developed a profile. And for example, did a 250-mile journey around James Ross Island on the sea ice, counting cells every time we had a rest day to get a profile of a very physical type of exertion, to contrast other journeys which were more mental. And psychologically, I thought it was quite important because of people being selected for jobs. You could do an eosinophil test to find out whether you were suitable or not. But of course, the data were obviously anecdotal rather than, you know, huge numbers or something like that. And so it was okay for an MD thesis, which was actually commended by Edinburgh University. But that was the end of that. I wasn't going to become a psychologist with my career.
So were you, when you put the cells or the blood under the microscope and you added the ingredients which clarify the picture, were you counting the number or the size? How were you telling what was good and what was bad?
Yes, you look down the microscope and you're looking at a draft board of etched squares and you say this square's got one in it, this square's got two in it, this has got none in it. But you're identifying them and recording in a book. And the remarkable thing that first came out about that was that everybody has a different count to start with. And I realised I had got a fingerprint, and I thought that of forensic interest, that if on the half a dozen people I was studying, for example, I could tell whose blood it was by the number of eosinophils. Some people had only got 40 in a cubic millimetre of blood, and others got 400 in a cubic metre of blood, but it went up and down from their own personal level.
Hmm.
And nobody's really discovered exactly what eosinophils do. They know that they increase in allergic conditions, for example, but it's still a great mystery, and one of these mysteries in medicine. Is it good to have a lot or is it good to have a little? And I never knew that. But you have to find out what each person's normal is in the base hut. So we had a base hut secure level. Then you had a base hut excitement level with something happening on the base, a relief ship, which was very few relief ships there, like one or two a year, this sort of situation. Then leaving on a journey the next day, for example, or involved in rescue situations, people falling down crevasses. And a desperate small boat rescue situation that I got involved in. The Hope Bay base at the end of the Antarctic Peninsula looks down onto Hope Bay, which the current swirls around during the tides at about 4 knots. And one day we saw a rowing boat out in the bay and a chap waving in it. And we got the binoculars out and realised that what had happened was he'd run out of petrol and he'd got no oars. He'd forgotten the oars. The wind was offshore. And the question was, the current was going out into the Antarctic Sea and he was clearly a goner if somebody didn't do something very quickly. It was winter. Just a little light.
Do you remember who it was?
Well, actually, it was an Argentinian, but that makes the thing more complicated. They were slightly more foolhardy. And the base leader, I wasn't the base leader, the base leader said, you know, that we've got a boat, it's in the ice at the shore. So the whole base turned out, we're picking axes to get this boat that was frozen at the ice on the shore. And the base leader said, diesel mechanic, you get the outboard motor, one outboard motor, could you get the outboard motor working? And he couldn't get it going. So after an hour, and by now the chap was just a speck in the distance, floating out with an offshore wind, and it was beginning to snow. what happened was the boat was eventually got out of the ice, and it realised there was a plank missing from the top of the thing, so it wasn't all that seaworthy. It was a very small boat. But what boiled down to was there was a big argument, because the bay sailor didn't want anybody to leave. But three of us got into the boat. That's Roger Tuft, and I can't remember who the other guy was, and we rowed out in the direction of where the boat had last been seen. And when we got about a mile out to sea, we realised we had no hope in hell of seeing him. It was snowing hard, the wind was offshore, and we realised what were we looking for? I mean, the chap was several miles out now. So then the moment of truth came when we tried to row back and found the wind was too strong, we couldn't make anything of it. And then we found that the waves were coming over the bows of the boat, so one person had to bail and two people had to row absolutely flat out. We're all very, very fit. So there were a lot of ice floating around, including an iceberg, so we went and sheltered behind the iceberg and thought what we were going to do next. The wind was getting stronger and the weather forecast was bad. And then we realised that if we didn't go straight back to the base but went on a sort of tangential line down the coast, the wind wouldn't be so much against us and we could gain against it. And some hours later, we finally made the coast several miles downstream. And absolutely exhausted, we got out of the boat, went back to the base. The base was now storm-bound. The Argentinians, who were several miles away, came up to the base to find out what the score was, but they said, I'll tell you what, we've sent a signal out to the icebreaker, the Saint Martin, which is about 400 miles away, and it's gone, put on emergency speed to go and try and find this guy. Well, a day passed, and this place was still storm-bound, and then we heard the helicopters couldn't take off from the Saint Martin. But the next day, two helicopters arrived at the base, but they said it was too bad to take off. So they stayed for some hours, and then they decided the weather was lifting, and then they went in search of where they thought the boat might have been. And they found him 20 miles out, lying in the bottom of the boat. He was never brought back to Hope Bay. The Argentines were very ashamed of the whole incident. And he was taken back to the Argentine directly, so we never saw him again.
But he lived.
But he was alive. And I'm trying to remember his name. He was a ballet dancer in his private life. And I could probably remember his name some other time if I thought more. But after that incident, we had very, very low eosinophil counts the next day, because I think we thought at the time it was a very, very close call. Now,
cells were responding to the stress or the anxiety levels inside the human
body. Yes, the brain interprets anxiety, and it varies between everyone. Like taking an exam the next day or something like that. And what happens is the brain then signals to the adrenal gland, which is sitting on the kidney, to produce more stress hormone. Now, what the stress hormone does is it reallocates the body resources. For example, it mobilizes sugar into the blood where it's being stored. It's being stored in the liver as glycogen. It releases sugar into the blood for the supposed emergency. And in the long term, it will, for example, burn up muscle to make new energy. So it's revamping the whole of the status quo of the individual.
So is it a simple equation that the more of these cells you have, the better able you are to cope with stress, or the fewer cells you have, the better you are able
We don't know the answer to that question. The question of what eosinophils do is just completely unknown. It's just an observation that they do fluctuate with the prevailing stress hormones. Stress hormones mainly called cortisol, which comes from this adrenal gland, and it rises and falls. The issue in civilizations is whether people who have high levels of preventing cortisol are more likely to get high blood pressure and fail because their interpretation of stress all the time, and they're revamped their metabolism, their general running of their body for a stress emergency situation as opposed to normal living.
So the chap who who was sent home after a year.
Actually, I remembered what his name was. His name was Oscar Bempo.
So he was sent home and he had very high.
Well, he was sent home, and of course I never got a chance of studying him again. But what I'm saying is that the eosinophils on the rescuers, the supposed rescuers, who were completely unsuccessful, was very, very low. It goes down. The eosinophils go down with stress hormone levels.
Right.
And sometimes even to zero. For example, in laboratory experiments, you have rats who are half drowned. Their eosinophil levels will be nearly zero. And the work relating to eosinophil started with a famous physiologist called Selye, who talked about the stress of life and tried to extrapolate from the levels. What he found was that animals that were stressed, like being subjected to cold or subjected to forced swimming or something like that, that when they had a post-mortem carried out, they had very, very big adrenal glands because they were making a lot of this adrenal stress hormone, cortisol, and the cortisol in turn diminishes the mud eosinophil cells.
How did your FIDs react to the idea of becoming guinea pigs for your research? Were they cooperative?
They were very cooperative, but the secret ploy I had was there were 12 people on the base. I'd only ask half of them. And I never wondered whether the other half... And I said, well, I tell you what, I'm going to want to take blood off and do this test and so on and so forth. Are you willing to cooperate? They all said yes. But the other half I never asked. And I thought it was quite good to play one against the other. Never, whether that was a silly idea or not, I don't know. But I think it's got a lot of relevance to life in general. But it was a research project which I couldn't really take any further when I got back into talk to psychologists, for example. But the point is that these stress hormones have these rhythms, and it was the rhythms that I then went off on.
Mm. And that's led you to the work now you're doing with breast cancer.
Well, then you see, that was rhythms living on a 21-hour day, an 8-day week in continuous daylight conditions, in the
Greenland.
Midsummer sun in Spitsbergen.
Spitsbergen, yeah.
But that then led to, okay, what's the importance of all these things? Perhaps it's important to breast cancer because the breast is a rhythmic thing. People don't understand. The breast changes in size during the menstrual cycle by about a fifth. The blood flow changes in it. The water content changes. And so it's a very cyclic organ. And by studying the cycle, maybe you can see who, for example, if they get cancer, is going to have a cancer which is get into the blood supply, which is different at different times as compared with others. Is it a survival matter then?
Shall we move on to something else? Let me ask you about what you found in the waters of Lake Boakella. What did your microscope reveal?
Well, the main thing you see is things called water bears.
Bears?
It's spelled B-E-A-R-S, but in fact, it looks a bit like a caterpillar. It's a tiny microscopic caterpillar. And there were other things, but I didn't get much further than that because I wasn't a zoologist. I mean, technically, it's called a limnological survey, and other people may have done that. But it was more for the fact that I was an academic at heart, and I wanted to do something, and it was expressed in terms of, oh, well, why don't I have a look at Lake Boakella?
Were you surprised to find any life at all in the lake,
yes.
Bearing in mind it was frozen 11
Bearing
months.
In mind that it was frozen solid in the winter. And then Shackleton discovered that if you freeze these water bears, they can minus an incredible amount. They still wake up when the water's changed. And, of course, that's very interesting biologically, because if you freeze... Inside a cell, everything's made of cells. Inside a cell, a whole lot of little subcompartments like energy making machines, and if you freeze it, you take out, freezing is fresh water, so everything has got much more concentrated salts in it. Does that kill you? I mean, that kills humans if you freeze humans too much. That's the trouble. It changes the ratios of the different things that are dissolved in the fluids. A lot of people don't realise that the polar ice, of course, is fresh water. And when I had an attempt on the North Pole, we were using polar ice all the time, and now people are worried with global warming that all this fresh water is sunk to the bottom of the ocean and is going to change the Gulf Stream.
Okay, let's look at one or two of the expeditions you did whilst you were south, and in no particular order, you did a trip to Brown Bluff, which was a skiing trip, is that right?
Yes, well, when I got to Hope Bay, Major Ellie Anderson was the base leader, and he was rather authoritarian and quite a dominant character, supposed to be married to some princess or something, he was that sort of character. And the first thing he said, all right, you're the doctor, here's a revolver, we need some Adélie flesh for a dinner in London. So you go out and shoot some penguins and find out how much we get off each breast of the Adélie penguins. And I went out and shot a couple of penguins, did what he said. But the thing was clearly a farce. It was going to have to be sent on the ship back to London for this stupid dinner. And so I wasn't actually very enthusiastic about him. And then John Heap, who was head of the Polar Region section at the Foreign Office afterwards, and who had done, he had done geography when I was doing medicine at Edinburgh, said, Hugh, I said, we could go to this peak called Brown Bluff, which is about, I suppose, 10 miles from Hope Bay. And he said, I'll be able to see the Antarctic Sound. I'll be able to monitor the sea ice that's floating there, which is what I'm doing for my PhD, the distribution of sea ice in the Southern Ocean. And the idea that two people would go off and ski to this thing, which hadn't been climbed before, Ellery Anderson was extremely unenthusiastic, but the point was that John had the academic trump card, and so the two of us set off on our skis to this point, and it was a long trip, but normally you weren't allowed away from the base unless you got a dog team and sledge and 10 days' food. We just went off with a little rucksack. But with my Scottish experience of going in the mountains, there was nothing to that. And John Heap was a sort of kindred spirit and later became in charge of the Heritage Trust. And I could talk more about the Antarctic heritage, because I think that's one thing that would be of interest to you. Now, Roger Tuft and I were, well, at least I was asked to go to this Livingston Island, which is in the South Shetlands group, to look after a rookie geologist who was going to look for metals for interest of the government. And Roger, the geologist called Hobbs, and the island is about 30 miles long with an ice cap in the middle, but a lot of ice-free capes going out from the ice cap, rather like the spines of a starfish. Anyway, it was a great privilege to be on this party, because we were landed by a helicopter with 3 months' supplies, and they said, we'll come back in 3 months and pick you up. I mean, it's just amazing when you think about it. But
this was virgin territory, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was this virgin territory?
It was almost virgin territory. We knew that the Discovery had landed there in the 1930s, and there were some pictures, but it was virtually virgin. And the question was, these rocky coasts could be great havens of wildlife, which we were interested in. Well, when we landed, there were Weddell seals on the beach, there was crab eater seals, there was elephant seals, there was South Atlantic shags, there were leopard seals feeding off the coast, and it was just a haven of wildlife. So we travelled over the island, particularly to the west end, which is 6 miles of volcanic rock and gravel, and an absolute Antarctic paradise for wildlife. So the three of us moved over the ice cap, man-hauling a sledge with our food on it, and then stopping at each peninsula and having a look round. Now, we knew that many years ago, this place had been very important because animal oil was used for lubricating the early machines of the Industrial Revolution. I'm talking about the early 1800s. Mineral oil wasn't really going then to lubricate the machines, but even people were having street lighting running off whale oil. And the first ship really to land in this area, in the South Shetland Islands, was in 1819. An Englishman who was going from Valparaiso to Montevideo, sailing round the Cape, perhaps of course he went further south, he landed, and he realised it was important to claim this land, so he landed with the Union Jack and so on. I think it was early 1821. Now, what happened was the news got out that this was an absolute haven of wildlife, and it was well known in the New England ports at that time, and people could make a fortune by getting a lot of this oil. The oil was mainly from the elephant seals. So what happened then was that everybody who could sail south from the New England ports did so. Now, that was difficult because there was a blockade off the west coast, off the east coast of America at that time by the British ships. And indeed, an incredible thing is that I actually have the sailing directions of my great-great-grandfather, who was actually in the British patrols. I've actually got his orders to sink ships in that area from 1815. Anyway, to get back to Livingston Island, we came onto one cape, and there in front of us on the beach was a huge sea cave. Now, what I mean by a huge sea cave, it was close to the waterline. The entrance was about 20 feet high, and it was about 20 feet broad. And there was this great hole of blackness looking into it, and we walked in, and we saw a whole ring of vertebrae, whale's vertebrae, as if men had been sitting there. And then we saw a knife on the table, all rusty, and at the side were barrel staves. And we assumed, of course, the barrel staves were from barrels. The wood had actually rotted, that this was the oil that the men had been putting in. It was a boat hook. And then on the beach outside was a rudder that was about, I suppose, 4 or 5 feet high, with the pintail still attached, but made of very, very rough wood. And there were spars of a ship with wooden pulley wheels on it, which we thought must be old. But then the most extraordinary thing of all was that one of the whale's vertebrae was carved with a man's name. And it was quite clear. And the name was B.S. Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, and then as a superscript were the letters S-C-H-R, which we interpreted as schooner. So we photographed everything very, very carefully and left it in situ. And later on, we discovered 20 other places where people had camped, stone circles, usually with whalebone as a bit of a roof, a bit of sailcloth at the edge. So in other words, it had been as little a house where they'd lived. And we wondered if this was, in fact, these people looking for seal oil, whale oil, about 1820. See, that's 80 years before Captain Scott and, you know, the romantic period of British Antarctic exploration. Mm. Well, as I say, we photographed all that, and this work is unpublished. And so when I got back to this country, I wrote to the New England Museum at Mystic in Connecticut and said, does this name, Cutler, mean anything to you? And the remarkable thing is that the The head of the museum at that time was called Cutler. I thought it might be some connection. That was actually a wild was a herring. Anyway, nothing happened for 30 years. And my letter lay in the museum in Connecticut. And then then at Christmas, about 3 years ago, I had a letter. And the letter said, I am the great-great-grandfather.
Grandson.
The great-great-grandfather of Benjamin S. Cutler. And he lives in America, so I've now got a correspondence going with the direct descendants. And Benjamin S. Cutler had sailed in the spring of 1820 for the Southern Ocean, having got married in the January of that year. And we have a description of him landing in Livingston Island. And when he got back, he was very young. He was born in 1811. So 1820s. I've not got that quite right. He was just a teenager on the ship. The ship made so much money that he was able to buy the ship. And I actually have the purchase document of the US government of Benjamin S. Cutler buying the ship. He became a master mariner. And the family legend is that he showed Fitzroy how to sail Darwin through the Beagle Channel. We don't have, I've got Darwin's diaries, and I don't have verification of that, but that is the family folklore. And so there is a complete continuity of history from the name on the vertebra, which I have. So I have a correspondence going with him, and we've tried to write it up with the National Geographic, but they weren't interested. Anyway, I have a correspondence going with them, and that's, I have a whole box in my room here full of, for example, the sales document, the purchase document of the ship. And Benjamin S. Cutler is mentioned actually in Brian, the guy who was before John Heap as the Polar Region section of the Foreign Office, a well-known senior guy. Anyway, he records Benjamin S. Cutler on the early Antarctic sailing. If you look at the history of early Antarctic sailings, Benjamin S. Cutler is there, and he sailed many, many times to the Southern Ocean. And he was obviously a very good mariner to have done that. It was very hard, you know, these days before there was... I mean, captains got the advantage of steam if they got into difficulties. So I've all the documentation. Now, what's happened in the end, I don't know whether you want to cut this out and so on, is that FIDS got my report, and there's an extensive report of this in the FIDS files. I reported everything we found, photographs and so on, some photographs. I kept the colour ones. And they sent down Fergus O'Gorman, who was a zoologist, because we also discovered on one of these peninsulas in Livingston Island to be fur seals. And those were the first fur seals that had been seen in the South Shetlands. In the time that I was in that area, they're found much further south now, but that was the first sighting. And Fergus O'Gorman, a zoologist, interested in which type of fur seal it was, he was sent down by Fitz to pick up the vertebra, and everything has been lost. So I've got all the photographs, but the relics are not there.
I'm sorry, when Fergus got there, they'd gone?
No.
Right, Fergus found them, and they've gone since then.
Brought all things back, and they've vanished.
So Fergus returned them to Bass?
Yes.
And they've gone...
He was... My understanding of the story, and I've got fragments of the story, is that they were sent to pick up all the relics. Now, how true that is, I don't know. But I do know that for people who've been down there since then, there's nothing left.
Mm.
The Chileans have also reported some discovery of relics and presumably taken them. What I've got is all the pictures as the things were originally found. So it was rather like the tomb of Tutankhamun as far as we were concerned. Mm. And the photographs are excellent. So it's just another project. The trouble is I got so involved with this project that I can't get to that at the moment.
One of the reasons you went to Livingston Island with Roger Tuft, I believe, is because you were looking for copper, is that correct?
Yes. What happened was we could see copper standing on some of the rocks, and that is what Hobbs was interested in, but we sledged over there and got some samples and so on, and there wasn't anything of commercial value. But what happened was that these peninsulas, these sort of tentacles which run out from the ice cap, Hobbs noticed immediately with the volcanic sand in places that there were a whole succession of raised beaches. So when he came back, he wrote up about the levels of these beaches. And the interpretation was, of course, that the land had been heavily under ice until comparatively recent geological time, and successively had raised itself, causing raised beaches. So he wrote an MSc thesis on that. And I've got a copy of his thesis here, but I'm slightly out of touch with it. But so the interest wasn't in the rocks so much as in the geological formations. And it was quite clear on some of the peninsula that the sea level had been much higher on the rocks than it was now. Mm. And maybe that was why the sea cave was completely out of the water.
Tell me a bit more about your friendship with Roger Tuft, because you did several projects with him.
Well, Roger Tuft was a very special companion, and the reason is that you could be in a tent with Roger Tuft for a whole month or longer, and Roger's always got something new to say. It might be about the sexual activities of Henry VIII or something silly like that. But Roger was basically an academic and interested in the wildlife in the Antarctic, the birds of the Southern Ocean, for example. And he's very strong, physically very fit. Now, in 1957, Roger and I had an idea when the ship left that we'd get the ship to land some stores on the Antarctic Peninsula, well away from Hope Bay, and we would then be able to pick up these stores and try and get onto the central spine of the plateau of what is called the Detroit Plateau. And so the last ship left Roger and me and some others there, party of six, and we had an 86-day journey to try and find routes onto the top of that plateau. Roger was a key man, so our base camp was a place called Pitt Point, and we had the plateaus about 5,000 feet high there, and obviously it's a major thing to try and get dogs and stores up. There had been a previous route found by Victor Grussell, who was one of the original Finns in 1945, and Victor kept fantastic records. He was a very, very strong sledger, and he did the original mapping around Pitt Point, and he found a route onto the plateau. We tried to do better than he had done with a whole succession of journeys in 1956. We never managed to improve. We always got stuck on the crest of the plateau. But eventually, Roger and I got on Victor Russell's route. We got to his nunatak, which is now named actually after me, on the edge of the plateau at about 3,000 feet, and found Victor Russell's depot there. And then Roger and I sledged onto the crest of the plateau, and that was one of the great moments of my life, because from 5,000 feet on a clear day, we could see the Bellingshausen Sea on one side, the Weddell Sea on the other side, and in the we could see where Shackleton's ship, because the visibility is so good in the Antarctic, we could see where Shackleton's ship Endurance had foundered. And we were then, 120 miles from base, or something like that. and we sledged back, and it was on the return journey that we very nearly were finished. The curious thing is the glacier we were on is called the Victory Glacier because Victor Russell had found it the day when VE Europe was found. It's a huge glacier, and it's a place where the wind can come through a channel from one side of the Antarctic Peninsula to the other, from the Bellingshausen Sea to the Weddell Sea. Famous, do not camp in places like that. So there were two teams. Roger was in one tent and I was in the other. And the trouble was there was no depth of snow. The glacier was virtually dry with little bits of snow in between. And when the first gust of wind caught us that night, I thought, you know, there's no way we can stand this. Although the tents are supposed to be able to stand 100 knots, it just was a wind that we'd never quite experienced before. What happened was that it was the middle of winter then, so there was very little light. There was a tremendous gust of wind. Both tents were flattened immediately. The sledge, which had been anchored upwind of the tent, blew over the top of the tent. And we wanted to get out. The terrific feeling of claustrophobia, it was dark. The wind was absolutely terrific. And we got a feeling of being trapped, which was actually almost a fatal thing. We should have stayed in the collapsed tent, which was frozen into the ground. So what happened was the other tent had the same experience. So we took our sleeping bags into the open. And what I remember was the clouds were going past. There was a moon. And we felt something almost biblical had happened, that the clouds had opened, and sort of the light from the moon, of course, very bright with the snow. And our sleeping bags had this very thick cover on them, so we weren't immediately going to get wet. We would keep the weather away at a distance. And in the morning, in about 2 hours of light that we had, we could see the two tents. The poles had broken, and we could see that what we could do was to make one tent out of the two and all four men get into it. So we moved about a mile and dug a huge hole in the snow, put up the one good tent in it, and all got in. And at that moment, as we lit the primus is absolutely life-giving. To be able to get a primus going in difficult conditions is where your life comes from when you're absolutely frozen and things. But we noticed that the flames of the primus were getting bigger and bigger, and the candles were going out, and we suddenly realized we'd got carbon monoxide poisoning because the tent was wet. It was just on freezing point, and there was no oxygen getting in. And so we burst out of the tent and found the dogs had eaten away into one of the boxes and eaten all the butter and things like that. But after we'd survived that, we then managed to continue on our journey back to viewpoint and get back, as I say, 86 days after we'd actually started out, which was really quite a long time. Now, I'd done the Easterville counts throughout this journey, and the only reason I had any records left was because I always get my data book in this sleeping bag. And to get an idea of the stress, when we woke up the morning after the tent had been flattened, Roger Taft was the only one with any energy left. We were exhausted. He said, "I'll go and look downwind for what I can find, because the 50-pound food box had just blown away." And he came back after a few minutes and said, "Well, I found two boots." We'd had some leather boots as well as our normal canvas snow boots. And he said, "Clearly, you only wanted two." And when I looked at them, one was left and one was... they were both left foot. So Roger, evidently, he had the strength, but he was still so exhausted, he hadn't realised what the situation was. But... that's the sort of companion that you need to have on a journey. And years later, after the Antarctic He came to Spitsbergen for 6 months with us. We sledged onto the ice cap. He later skied across Greenland with us. And later on, we had an attempt, the Daily Telegraph North Pole expedition, where three of us tried to go to the North Pole unsupported. And Roger was on that too. So it's a sort of lifelong companion. People go to the Antarctic for different reasons. But he went, I think, because of his intellectual curiosity and satisfaction about the whole polar environment, the animals, the birds, and that sort of thing. And of course, if you're interested and read about where you are, you don't get bored.
Let's leave it there, Hugh, and I think Myrtle's got some lunch for us.
Okay.
Then we'll come back and do some more.
This is, yeah.
Marvellous. Thank you very much. Thank you.